on ABC Radio.
This is The Big Fish
with Scott Levi.
Good morning. Welcome aboard. First cast on The Big Fish this morning, Dr. Anna Clark, author of The Catch, A History of Fishing in Australia, takes us fishing with Cook and Phillip. Captain Cook and Phillip, that is. Previously with Anna on The Big Fish, we found out about the brilliant Aboriginal fisherwomen of Sydney. This time, the fascinating history of the fish caught from the Endeavour in Botany Bay. Of course, they dangled a line over the side. Cookie probably had one out of the captain's window. We'll find out what was in Captain Phillip's tackle box on his boat on the First Fleet and other fishy stories about the colonists. Fantastic stuff. Great history this morning of fishing. Peter Monsoon Morse joins us from Kinchant Dam in Queensland on the quest for the giant barramundi that swim there, and also takes a Saratoga fishing with fly. Stinker has his theory on why Port Stephens flathead fishing has never been better. And Joe Starling joins us from Cairns after an angling adventure on the Coburg Peninsula. Joe also breaks the news that she's heading into a fly-only gear gap year, or a floggy, if you want to use the acronym. Why would you subject yourself to such torture? We'll find out this morning in this episode of The Big Fish. I reckon that The Catch by Anna Clark, Dr. Anna Clark, is the best fishing book I've ever read. The story of fishing in Australia. And first cast a few weeks ago, Anna spoke about the wonderful Aboriginal fisher folk and what we knew about their 65,000 years of being custodians of the land and the sea. But what was it like fishing with Cook and Phillip when they first rocked up? And many of us, I'm sure, have asked that question.
One of the funny things about fishing is that really until modern industrial fishing with, you know, refrigeration and diesel engines and so on, fishing is relatively unchanged for thousands of years. A hand line is a hand line is a hand line. And a fishing rod is essentially a stick with a line on the end of it and some sort of rudimentary form of, you know, pulling it in. And a fishing net still does the same thing. You know, you stick it in the water and you haul up fish. So in terms of the technologies between Indigenous fishers and the first Europeans who arrived, the principles were basically the same. The difference was, of course, Europeans came with steel hooks, which made a big difference, and Aboriginal people actually availed themselves of the hooks and were really enthusiastic when they were given hooks to use around Sydney and the south coast of New South Wales.
Hey, you even know how many hooks were in Captain Phillip's tackle box?
Yeah, don't test me though, because
8,000.
8,000. I know. The wonderful thing about Australia being started as a convict colony is that everything is recorded because, you know, it's like a jail sort of tuck shop box. Everything, all the ingoings and outgoings are meticulously recorded. All the tattoos on the prisoners and all of the things that were bought in the holds of the First Fleet, and some of those things, as you said, were 8,000 fishing hooks and a few nets as well.
That's a big tackle box.
Yeah, that's pretty serious, isn't it? But they had some pretty big boats to stick it in.
And they had some pretty big fish. And this is great because everyone talks about Banksias and Banks and kangaroos, but no one talks about the fish until now. And you've got the irrefutable evidence of what they were catching, giant fish.
Yeah, there were some incredible stories when Cook came into Botany Bay of one of his crewmen spearing enormous stingrays, you know, 150, 200 kilogram stingrays. And they were, as a rule, not eaten by the Eora traditional owners around the area. And no one really knows why. It's one of those many bits of information that's been lost over the time. But stingrays, unless it was a very lean time, stingrays were avoided by local Aboriginal fishers for eating. So they were huge, like, you know, you can imagine, as big as a dining table. And they were speared very, you know, on the first day that the Endeavour arrived. And also they dropped the net somewhere around the north of Botany Bay. And within just a couple of hauls, they had a couple of hundred kilos. There were so many fish in Australia in those times.
That was that sailor Lou Derrick. Mm. He put the same net out. You document 300 pounds of something of blackfish.
I know.
His name really wasn't Lou Derrick, by the way, but yeah, I just made it.
Johnny John. Fishy McFishface. I go there all the time to go snorkeling, and it's beautiful. It's still beautiful. There are beautiful grasslands. There's lovely fish swinging around, morwong, blackfish, whiting. But, you know, to think that you drop a net and pull out 150 kilos, sight unseen, not knowing what's under there, it just gives you an indication of how many fish were around in those days.
But you also document the boom and bust nature of things like mullet and blackfish, don't you? Because they didn't
understand that.
They got 300 pounds of blackfish.
Yeah. And they
only there at a certain time, as the Aboriginal people knew.
That's right. And the sort of the seasonal unpredictability of fishing in Australia was a real shock to them, because the first fleet arrived in January, and the fishing's great in Sydney and around those parts, as you know, your listeners all know, in New South Wales, really until the cold winter months, I'd say up until sort of July, August, starts to sort of quieten down a bit. So they were catching fish, and then there were none. And they would have starved had it not been for some of those Eora fisherwomen who were sort of helping them get through, to be honest.
It's lovely what you write about Arthur Phillips saying to a fellow on the boat that pulled in a big brim.
Yeah, that's right. He was the first non-Indigenous person to
catch. Sydney Cove.
Yeah, that's right, in Sydney Harbour, to catch a fish. And Arthur Phillip, as many of your listeners might know, the first fleet arrived in Botany Bay, and they thought, oh, this isn't so great. You know, there's not a lot of water. It's very exposed. The sand dunes are very sort of dry and arid. And they thought, oh, we've heard about this possible cove a little bit north. We'll go and check it out. So Phillip took up there with a small boat and some crew, and they sailed and paddled up from Botany Bay around into Port Jackson, and thought, oh, this is unbelievable, this is fantastic. But while they were exploring the area and finding some fresh water, they had to leave a guy on the boat, otherwise it would have, you know, sort of sailed off somewhere by itself. While he was there, he was a fisherman from England, and he thought, oh, bugger this, I'm not going to stay here doing nothing. And he dropped a line in and, yeah, pulled up an enormous brim.
I, being the boat keeper, I had to remain in the boat.
Yeah.
As you say, read between the lines, bugger this, yeah. I'm going to go fishing. And I hove my line over. I hauled up a large black brim, B-R-I-M,
yes,
and hove it into the stern sheets of the boat.
Yes.
Coming into the barge, Philip, that is, the big boss, observed the fish I had catched, K-E-T-C-H-E-D. And he said to me, recollect that you are the first white man that ever caught a fish in Sydney, S-I-D-N-E-Y, Cove, where the town is to be built.
Yeah, it's a lovely story.
Isn't that a great yarn? His name was Jacob Nagel.
Yeah.
Jacob Nagel. There's a name that should be remembered in colonial history.
Yeah, that's right.
But of course, you also document, and it's that time. This weekend, just gone past the dark of the moon, last weekend was the prawning run.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see people out at Swansea and some of the other places, the rip, where the water moves and the prawns and the crabs come up in the dark of the moon with lights, fishing. But the Aboriginals knew all about that, didn't they?
They certainly did.
You've got irrefutable evidence of them doing spotlighting. Well, they didn't have electricity, but they had other things.
Yeah, that one of the first things that Joseph Banks saw on the Endeavour the first night in Botany Bay, they sort of stuck it, you know, flung their anchor over and was sitting there bobbing in the afternoon light that then turned into evening. And as he peered out across the water, he noticed an incredible sight of all of these sort of lights bobbing along the bay, and for a second he didn't know what he was looking at. And then he realised, of course, they were night fishers, and it was Aboriginal men mostly, standing in their canoes holding flaming torches, which attract the fish and other sea creatures to the side of their boats. And they were night fishing. And there are stories about that sort of fishing all around the coast, right up into the Northern Territory. There are stories of Aboriginal people standing on the sides of mighty rivers, attracting barramundi to the sides of the rivers in the middle of the night with flaming torches as well.
Just imagine that. You've got this soup of prawns coming up around the boat, the big snapper and the brim and everything else coming up.
Squid.
It was pretty new to them, I guess.
Yeah, the whole fishing scene was new to them. They, you know, the seasons are the wrong way around, and the water temperature is often a couple of months behind the seasons, and different fish, as you mentioned earlier, have different migrating patterns. So Aboriginal people knew all of this information. They knew that when there was a sign on land, like there were lots of lorikeets or magpies or certain moons and so on, then the prawns would be running, or the ludric or the mullet would be running. When the water was blooming, the tailor would be out offshore, out of Fraser Island. But this is all new information for non-Indigenous people. And when they arrived, they really arrived with, you know, no fishing guides. And all they arrived, as you said, was a tackle bag.
Yeah, and they had plenty of hooks and plenty of lead and got stuck into it. You're right. There were so many fish in Australia that the question for early colonists wasn't how to catch them, but what to do with the catch. Were they salting? Were they drying? Were they preserving?
Yeah, that's a really good question. In the early days, there was a lot of bartering. And, you know, the colony was obviously very small, so you could get a load of fish around it very easily. But as it expanded into different areas, bringing fish down from, you know, Port Macquarie or Newcastle down to Sydney is obviously tricky when there's no ice and no refrigeration and the only transport is by cart or boat. So as the colony expanded and more people came and there was a bigger market for fish, paradoxically, people kind of ate less fish, because unless you lived right next to a fishing community or you were a fisher yourself, it was very hard to get fresh fish.
But of course the people on the first fleet were dangling lines over the side. Of course Captain Cook's crew and probably even Cookie himself had a line over the stern.
Yeah,
out
absolutely.
Of the captain's window. They did it. And why hasn't this been written into history, or it's there in the archives, as you've found?
I know. It's funny, isn't it? And in one of the wonderful things about doing this research at now is that so many of these archives have been digitised. So it's actually accessible to anybody who has an interest in fishing history to go and find, you know, to go and read Cook's journal or go and read Banks's journal or go and read some of those early accounts by, you know, Collins or Hunter or any of those early colonial figures, because many of them have been digitised and they're freely available. So we can all get a sense of what it was like, and also the wonderment. Like, you know, they came all this way and they came to a place that was, you know, it was like travelling to Mars for them, but it was Mars that was full of fish, and they are really staggered. At first they're staggered by the huge bounty, just what was out there. They couldn't believe their eyes at how many fish there were. But as they were here for a little bit longer, they realised that that bounty was actually a little bit tempestuous, and it was seasonal, as you said, and they couldn't understand, you know, why some days there'd be loads of fish and why some days there weren't any. So it took a long time to learn that information about how to fish here, how to keep catching fish, and how to sort of have a viable fishery.
Well, we'll fish our way through some of the chapters, and some fantastic stuff out of the 50s and 60s as you get towards the end of the book. A foreword by our own Big Fish correspondent Rob Paxavanis is a great forward, and like Rob, I agree. If this had been on the agenda at school, I would have paid attention in history. This is the sort of history that is riveting. He said, I couldn't put it down. It's called The Catch, The Story of Fishing in Australia. Anna Clark, thanks so much for joining us. And I know that you'll be heading out onto Sydney Harbour to do a bit of fishing. I know you're a keen fisher person as well, so tight lines.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. Thanks so much for having me on again.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Coming up, our Big Fish fly fishing correspondent Peter Morse, or as he's called, Monsoon Morse. Everywhere he goes, the rain follows.
I fished everywhere, man. I fished everywhere, man. Up beaches, boats and piers, man. I'm in up to my ears, man. With hand light rods or spears, man. I fished everywhere. I caught pinkies, kingies, dragon whiting, black brim, blackfish when they're biting, flathead, flounder, pike and hake, blue pointers, tiger sharks, that's flake, redfin, yellow belly, marigold, tarpon, brown trout, rainbows, even had a carp on.
Yeah, but what kind of bait?
Freshborn spivvies, crabs and cungy, beach worms, sandworms, sperma, spongy, whitebait, froggies, nippers, yabbies, ockies, squidgies, potties, crabbies, pilchards, mussels, cabbage, weed on, all the stuff fish love to feed on. I'll try any bait, mate.
to get fish on a plate, mate. I fish at early light, mate, and sometimes through the night, mate. I catch and then release, mate. Yes, I've fished everywhere.
Yeah, but name is a couple of spots, mate.
Cape York, Cooktown, Coleraine, Aruma, Mossman, Maryborough, Western Port and Cooma, Noosa, Bribe, Coolum, Gatticoolum, Harvey Bay, Byron Bay, Bowen and Maroolan, Brisbane, Gisborne, Bundaberg and Bunbury, Portland, Shark Bay. Boy, I'm in a quandary. Darwin down to Perth, mate, on a boat where there's a berth, mate, on a four-wheel in the outback, I'm set to hit the road, Jack, on a rock ledge when the tide's slack. Yes, I've fished everywhere.
Crikey, anywhere else?
Tweed to Servers, Ballina to Bundy, Gove to Darwin, the Reefs, Whitsunday, Gosford, Tarry, Wyndham, Warragamba, Burrinjuck, Tullibuck, Laurenton, Yamba, Frankston, Brighton, Air Tasmania, Esperance, Albany. Guess I've got a mania. I fished everywhere, man. I fished everywhere, man. Beaches, boats and piers, man. I'm in up to my ears, man. Whether handline, rods or spears, man. Yes, I fished everywhere. Fished here, there, everywhere. I fished everywhere. Gotta see your license, mate.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Peter Morse is on the Queensland Barra impoundment trail, but they're calling him the Rain Man up there because everywhere he goes, a cloud follows him. G'day, Morsey.
How are you, mate?
Yes. You're holed up in the camp and it's pouring down. Is that right?
Yeah, it's blowing like stink at the moment. We're between squalls. It's coming across in waves of heavy rain. And I'm at Kinchant Dam west of Mackay and a couple of local mates. And we're just sitting here drinking coffee and talking fishing at the moment. That's all we can do. We're not going to get out on the water. It's pretty ugly out there.
I've had a couple of calls from farmers in the Western District who want you to go out there urgently.
they've just had a long, dry winter here. It hasn't really rained since June. And this rain's been following me from, where did it begin? About Gladstone. And I went out west and fished some rivers on the Fitzroy system, and my vehicle is only two-wheel drive, my camper van. And I got to some beautiful remote water holes, but I think the Saratoga was spawning. They wouldn't bite. Got some sooty grunters, got one Saratoga and some big catfish. You know, I went subsurface with the flies and, of course, just battled catfish. The hit's great, but, you know, when you get them, them alongside, it's always a little bit disappointing. Oh, another big caddy. But I had to bail out of there, and I came up. I'm at Kinchant at the moment, west of Mackay, which has actually been fishing really, really well up until just the other day when I arrived.
Hey, Peter, I wanted to ask you about Saratoga, because I was watching one of Andy Thompson's videos from up that way, and he was in a lovely little river system catching some really big Saratoga and had a bit of underwater footage of catfish actually coming up trying to eat them, giant catfish. I always wondered about, because they're mouth breeders, when shouldn't we catch them? Or do they just go off the bite when their mouth...
Oh, they just go off the bite. Don't worry about that. When they're breeding, they will not bite.
Oh, no, that's good. That's good.
They just get lockjaw. Yep.
Well, that's very good to hear, isn't it? Because you wouldn't want to, you know, if they're mummy fish or daddy fish, I don't know which one carries them
daddy,
in. Daddy is swimming around with a mouthful of baby Saratoga. You really wouldn't want to try to get him to take a lure because the babies would be displaced.
They won't. They'll swirl on the fly. And I had some huge boils and the fish were definitely there. But, they're just not going to open their mouths. As you say, they've got a mouthful of babies, so. Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
A mouth breeder. Yeah, nature is extraordinary. Yeah.
And that's great. That's really, really put my mind at rest, Morsey, your knowledge, because I was worried about that. I lose sleep. Yeah. I lose sleep over these things.
Bless you, mate. Bless you. We've got to worry about the fish. Someone has to.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, if you've got fur and feathers, everyone cares. But the poor old fish, no one cares. Saratoga, what a wonderful, wonderful throwback to another age. Are they in Kinchant as well?
No, they're not in Kinchant. Not to my knowledge. Mind you, there's some enormous, I'm looking out over some enormous leopard beds. And some may have slipped some in. They're not in this particular system, but, you know, they're getting anglers are spreading them around all the impoundments in Queensland, which I think is a great thing because I think they're a wonderful fish. They're not a fish that's going to upset any ecosystem. And, of course, they're such a great fly rod fish. And I'm, you know, I love, they're in, certainly in my top 10 favourite species, easily. Yeah.
What's your favourite surface fly for the pit? Give us the recipe for those people down south who want to go up and have a go at taking one off the top.
Oh, certainly the Dahlberg, you know, spun deer here, Dahlberg, and gurglers. But I think it's also very important fishing with weed guards because often you're throwing into the lily pads or in among the snags, and the closer you can get, the better. Mind you, that southern Saratoga species, and there are two species, actually do a lot of feeding out in mid-water early in the morning. And they'll get out amongst all the wind-blown debris and leaf matter and so on and just sit stuff off the top, little ants and all kinds of stuff. So you get away with quite small flies and you've got to hold on to them. But they're a you know, a classic surface feeder. The other fly is a gurgler. So out in the middle, you don't need a weed guard, but certainly along the, during the day in among the shade of the big paper barks and in among the snags and among the lily pads, you certainly want a weed guard on your fly. And, gurgler and Dahlberg would be my two favourite. I have some, you know, most of your bass flies will work your little popper, you know, grasshopper patterns. They eat all sorts of insects. And I've actually watched them feeding in one clear water hole up here. I was trying to get some photographs of them feeding and set myself up with a telephoto lens. And the rise, the sipping off the top because of the shape of their mouth is so subtle, so delicate, fantastic to watch. But then, of course, when you get a big fly, you know, they'll crash it. But the other thing, in York a few years ago, and it had a bloody snake in it. You know, half the snake had been digested. The snake was still alive, and it was in the fish's neck. So, and it was a snake about 2 feet long. On the waterhole I was on, I watched a snake swim across this waterhole, expecting at any second a Saratoga to engulf it. But it didn't happen, unfortunately. I had the camera trained on it. But I guess that's possibly because they're breeding. So they'll eat big things as well. No problem there at all. They've got a very big mouth. And I remember a photo in Fly Life magazine taken by Al Simpson of a lizard that the Saratoga had eaten. And the lizard's tail was down the toga's throat and was partly digested. This live lizard was in the fish's mouth. Nature is an amazing thing.
What a way to go. What a terrible way to get bitten by a snake, trying to do the right thing and catch and release a Saratoga, because everyone lets them go. And aren't they a beautiful-looking thing? You know, you need a good photographer to do them justice, but with a nice SLR and good light, those subtle purple hues and spots on them, they're up there with a brook trout, aren't they, for looks?
Absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous fish. And the detail in their head is also just magnificent. The patterns and the, you know, they're a gorgeous fish. Why they're in my, you know, they hit a fly so well, eat off the top, and they're beautiful.
All right, well, look out, F and Q. The Morse monsoon is coming.
That's it, monsoon Morse. That's an old name of mine.
Hey, tight lines, Morsey. I hope you can get out of the tent and get a few of those giant kinchant barra. Thanks for joining us on The Big Fish.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Scott. Bye, mate.
From Tweedheads down to Eden and all across the state, the inland lakes and rivers, no matter what your bait. If fishing is your caper, then there is no better show than The Big Fish with Scott Levi on your weekend radio. Grab your boat, have some fun,
have some fun.
Tune in before the rising of the sun. Waymaster, Rivermouth, Snapper in the ACT,
Bushy way down south,
with Bonza seafood recipes and fishy tales galore, on the greatest fishing program to be heard across our shores.
listen to the guns. You'll fill your bag before the day's done. Then you'll be right in the know. Find out how to catch 'em on the big fish show. Roll your boat, have some fun. Tune in before the rising of the sun. With your mates and kids in tow.
Dinka and Joe Starling coming up next on The Big Fish.
This is The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Here comes Dinka with his fishing tips. Some hot advice for your fishing trip. Where to find them? What's the bait?
Are you catching any, mate?
Good morning, Stinker.
Hey, g'day, Scott. How are you going today?
I feel very good. I think it's all of those oysters I ate last weekend at the Oyster and Timber Festival. Enjoyed it thoroughly. The fishing comp, Kenny Baker and the crew from the Karua Motor Yacht Club Fishing Club, they gave out a swag of good prizes to the kids. And I must say, the biggest flathead was 57 centimetres. They caught about a dozen flathead inside and outside the pool.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it?
The bars must be wide enough for them to go in and out, I guess.
Oh yes, it is. It is. I mean, it's just pylons driven into the water, and they only keep out, I guess, sharks. That's about all of them keep out, I suppose.
That's all you want to keep out.
But no, the flathead and the brim and everything else can go in there. And they can just enjoy there's a bit of peace they can have until everybody, all the school kids turn up and start bombing them. They can have a great time in there. But just to think that you can catch a dozen flathead out of a swimming pool, it says a lot for the rest of the river, doesn't it?
I think so. And they're stuck in the one spot land-based. The little guy who caught the biggest flathead and won the biggest fish trophy, he cried when they made him let it go, but then his eyes lit up when they gave him the big trophy and the rod and the tackle box. Well done to Ken Baker and the crew there at the fishing club. It's a wonderful setup. A lot of people from the Hunter Valley use that as their water escape, Stinker.
Oh, yeah, it's a great place. Great place. Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with the oysters either, Scott.
Oh, boy, they've had a great season. The Cole brothers were saying that those 2 months of no rain leading up to the Oyster Festival meant that they grew significantly faster than usual, the higher salinity. They said it's the best season they've ever had. And the crowd was monstrous. The rain was tumbling down, and yet the people just keep rolling in, Stinker.
Yeah, yeah. It's great. And I spent 3 years up around the Karua area writing a book on the history of oyster growing in Port Stephens, and I really do enjoy going up there and seeing all the oyster growers. Many of them are retired now that I wrote about, because I've formed a lot of friendships up there over that period, and it's really great to go up and have a yarn to them and see them again. So yeah, that's what I enjoy most about the day, is seeing all the old oyster growers that I befriended when I was writing that book.
Now, a couple of dozen kids standing on the swimming pool, which is an open bath that is on the Karua River, catching all of those flathead, it surely says that the place is swarming. The harbour and the upper end of Port Stephens is swarming with flathead.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's an absolute mecca for flathead, and there's a reason for that. Port Stephens, in the western face of Port Stephens, are the most healthy mangrove forests, and it's just the home of life. It's boiling mass of life. Little shrimps and prawns and all sorts of juvenile fish, and it's warm and there's lush seagrass up there. And of course a big flathead, he just nuzzles into the soft, muddy, sandy mud and just waits for something to swim past. I mean, they don't chase food. Flathead don't chase tucker. Tucker comes to them. And so they just lie there. They know where to lie, by the way. They don't just, it's not a random selection. They know exactly where the most point of activity will be. And so once a snack swims past, zot, out they come and boom, they're gone. Whatever it was is gone. But if you now, that's what's made it so exciting for those that toss plastics, because if they can find where these big fish, or they don't have to be big, they're beautiful fish. They just toss them in front of the nose of the flathead and whacko, you're in. But one really great thing going on in this port, Scott, and it's been going on voluntarily for, I reckon, 15 years, and that is any flathead over 70 centimetres isn't kept. Now, by law, you can keep one, but I featured one in this week's newspaper. I put an article in every week, and it's 73 centimetres. Well, the photo was taken, the hook was taken out, and it was just sort of lowered back into the water and it swam away. And that's been going on here for a long, long time. And I reckon we're starting to reap the benefits.
A friend of mine, Matty Douse, is a fabulous underwater photographer, and he does a lot of shore dives. He loves that one at Port Stephens, and he took a photo of a big girl on the bottom in the little reserve area there. I think it's Fly Point, isn't it, or Halifax?
Fly Point. Halifax, they're in both those places. Yeah, they're everywhere.
He took a photo of a big girl lying on the bottom and about four males lying on top, jostling for position in the boudoir. The littler males were all around her. So that is testimony to... And maybe that's why there are so many people letting those big breeders go. They can lay so many more eggs, and the place is just infested with them. You went out the other day and smashed them, didn't you?
Oh, well, I mean, I took two. You know, that's plenty for me. Two flathead, and then caught a couple more, and then I just stopped fishing. I don't fish all morning and catch a heap of fish and let them go. I just catch pretty much what I went, then I have a break.
What do you look for, Stinker? I mean, you go out with some of those great blokes who really do haunt that estuary. You're more an outside man, but what are they looking for? What are some of the... Because it's a large expanse of water. What would you target if you were chasing the flathead in Port Stephens?
Oh, well, we went at dead low tide, the first of the run-in tide, in dawn, and that seems to be the peak period. That's targeted by most of the real guns around here. And then where shallow water drops down reasonably quickly into deeper water. But they'll all come up, all the snap flathead, and you can see their marks, their lays, where they've been through the tide, and then the tide drops and they move off, but they still leave their imprint in the sand and the mud. And they're quite sizable fish. I mean, there's some beautiful, beautiful flathead. But, I mean, not only flathead... There's a mulloway that I put in the paper this week, this week, and it was 27 kilo, and it was caught off the local breakwater right in the middle of Nelson Bay, at the end of the main street. Oh, golly, it's incredible the amount of quality fish that inhabit Port Stephens, and big brim, thumping big brim and they're mainly swallowing any cubed garfish or cubed pilchards or bonito I saw and cooked prawns on a number two hook, and you just toss it out and it with the tide will slowly wash it in close under the rocks, and that's where the big brim are. And they're a kilo and a half brim. They're absolute thumpers. And so there's brim, there's mulloway, there's beautiful, and the crabs. Have I gone on about the crabs yet?
No, you haven't yet. I'm just thinking you could put your crab pots in, because you're allowed to use new crab pots that don't let the turtles in, and that's been a great thing. But you could put those in, go and jig a couple of flathead, and then come back and get the crabs out, couldn't you?
That's the trick.
Is that the trick?
Or you can leave a trap overnight, which I have done through the week, and we had the biggest feed of blue swimmer crabs. I invited a few friends around, and I put them all in the middle and into it. A few cold beers, and off you go. And since we've stopped using witch's hats, we've caught incredible amount of crabs, which I think is just coincidental. I don't think that's got anything to do with the dropping of but we haven't caught any turtles. We haven't killed any turtles, and we've caught a heap of crabs, so everybody's happy. I was talking to a fella yesterday, one of my mates yesterday, who'd just come back from up in the Karua River, And he said there's a heap of turtles poking their heads up, which is just great. And they don't have to worry about getting tangled up in witches' hats. It's a really win-win situation. And I'm sure the turtles are pretty happy about that.
Yeah, excellent stuff. And to all of the people at Karua that we met on the weekend, wonderful festival. All those wood choppers, the handicap system. Even you and I could have had a go, Stinker. We could be off about 5 minutes, but still wouldn't get through the block of wood. But fantastic stuff.
I could have started the day before. I went in a wood chop once at the Gilgandra show, which was a very foolish thing to do. It's a wonder they let me do it. But I had a pair of thongs on and I jumped up on the log and I had an axe. I think they gave me one which was blunt as, you know, so I didn't cut my thong off, I suppose. And then I was off go and then everyone else started sort of 5 minutes later. Well, I hadn't even turned around. By the time the others had finished, I was still bruising one side of the log. It's not an easy thing to do. And what a big... Did you see the amount of people watching that?
Oh, I don't think they get anything like it outside of the Royal Easter Show. The people were everywhere.
It was a mass crowd.
Yeah, and I think it's become a big wood-chopping event. And we had a few bob on the side and a bit of a book running. But that's another story. And all of those oysters. I mean, how many oysters do you reckon the people consumed?
Oh. I wouldn't have a clue.
I'd say the population of Karua is going to triple. Nine 9 months down the track.
Anyway. If they all work, we're in for an invasion.
Tight line, Stinker.
There he's got.
On ABC Radio, it's The Big Fish with Scott Levi.
They always say to our Big Fish correspondents, go fishing, otherwise we'll have nothing to talk about. Joe Starling, good morning.
Good morning, how are you?
I don't think I need to twist your arm to go. Where have you been?
Oh, where haven't I been? I've been up north getting away from the rainy weather down my way. Last week I was fishing off the Coburg Peninsula in the Northern Territory. And right now, I've just finished fishing in Cairns. So.
Well, let's have a bit of a snapshot of your northern adventures. How did you go?
Oh, it was awesome. The Coburg Peninsula is one of those wonderful remote locations that not many people go to wet a line. I mean, a lot do, but we tend to overlook it a fair bit, so we don't automatically think of it. But boy, oh boy, it's a beautiful untouched part of the world and the fishing of yesteryear.
It just looks magnificent, doesn't it? Is it an area where the Indigenous people have control, or do you
absolutely?
So you have to. To work with the Aboriginal traditional owners to get in there and do that sort of thing?
Well, yes, you do. There's only actually, I think, 20 vehicles allowed in this particular park on any given day. So it's very, very pristine and fantastic. And the traditional owners are wonderful people, and they're very, very proud of their culture, and they'll take you out and do hunting and gathering and all that sort of thing as something extra to do if you so choose. But of course, being the person that I am, I said, thanks for that, but I'm going fishing.
I reckon they'd love that. And how did you go? Tell us about your adventure.
Oh, look, we had we took six people away with us from all over the country and introduced them to what we call the Hurt Locker, which is a specific reef up there off Smith Point. And you just cannot drop a slug or a plastic or anything or any kind of jig down and get to the bottom without it being ripped out of your arms by something big and toothy, and stretch your arms for the next 10 minutes trying to get it in. And we had all manner of trevally, your obligatory aerial acrobats in the queenfish, and mackerel and tuna, and we've got some beautiful coral trout, good-sized coral trout for the table, as well as mackerel.
Any black jew and finger mark and things like that?
We didn't. Yeah, we got some finger mark. We didn't get any black jew, but we got barra when we went estuary fishing, and lots of mangrove jack, and, you know, it was just a smorgasbord of great things, and many, many, many of them obviously released to keep entertaining us. But we did feed ourselves as well, and the food at the particular camp that we were based at was just exquisite. It was like five-star straight out of the ocean, and just divine. I can't recommend that part of the world highly enough for anyone who's looking for a blue water adventure. You know,
unless you're a weirdo who doesn't like coral trout and mud crabs, I guess.
Yeah, well, that is true. That is true.
There are some strange people who may not like that. What's the reef fishing like? Because I've done a lot of reef fishing way out off Townsville when I lived there for many years, and you'd go 60 nautical miles out and you'd drop a fair way down and you'd get good trout and you know, all some of those species you're talking about, not the finger mark so much. They're more inshore, but it was quite deep. By the look of it, those reefs around there are reasonably shallow, so you're not dropping forever either and you're feeling the bites better.
That's exactly right. Like some of the places where the best coral trout and all of those sorts of things and the what you call finger mark, I call golden snapper, being a Territorian, where they're all sitting, we were only fishing in sort of 6 to 9 metres of water and it was crystal clear. Sometimes you're throwing into something that looks like an aquarium and you feel really bad. They are absolute brawlers, and we got smoked so many times by things that we just couldn't stop from going back into their hidey holes and it just, you know, Queensland groper, stuff like that actually up there in the estuaries. They're unstoppable, and they've got burrows that go, I don't know how many metres back in underneath the mangroves, but, yeah, they beat me. And with lock drag and everything, and they're still... Yeah. That powerful, you know.
Just point the rod and lock up and hang on and wait till it pings, I guess.
Yeah, that was exactly it. Oh, there was one particular time where this big monster that I never saw took me back in underneath. I just thought it was underneath mangrove roots, but we got around and got a straight line to it because it was, you know, in and out of all the different mangrove roots and structure and everything, and then down in under the mangroves. And I thought, well, it can't be too far back in there, right? So I've given it some slack line and just told the skipper, just hold on a little minute, I'll just give it some slack line and see if I can feel anything. Like, you know how often when a fish feels like it's no longer fighting, it sort of goes, oh, okay, I'm all right, and you can feel it, but it's still there. So I did that, and sure enough, it's still there. So I put the drag back on and gave it a tug, and the bloody thing took off for a field line off me again for another, I don't know, 15, 20 metres. So somewhere in there underneath all that land, there are tunnels like in Vietnam. They're all full of really mean fish.
It's amazing, absolutely amazing. Yeah. We're speaking with Joe Starling, just back from adventures on the Coburg Peninsula as guests of the Aboriginal traditional owners.
So I did some awesome walks up one particular sacred site called Long Tom Dreaming, and a beautiful... Aboriginal guide there took us right up the top, and it was so humbling. You know, the rock art and everything was extraordinary, but he tested the waters with us, and once he realised that we were very respectful and mindful of where we were and I guess worthy people, he offered to take us to the very, very sacred part, no cameras allowed or anything, but their burial site. And I've got to tell you, I've never felt so small and insignificant in my life, but going into this extremely sacred place where the bones of elders, you know, traditional owners very long gone, are still there. And he let us go in and talk quietly in that space and visit those souls and all of that. And I'm almost crying now.
What a great experience. And that great connection to the land and also that shared bond of the fisher folk, being coastal people. I'm sure they really got what you're up to with your love of fishing. Now, you're doing, and that's the Coburg adventure. From now on, you're setting an interesting challenge for yourself, a flog year, I believe.
You're
floggy. Now, this is a fantastic thing, and we're going to follow you all the way. We'll stick with you. It's a bit like... some sort of going into some sort of rehab, you know. Don't want you to relapse back to the spinning gear unless you're in a tournament.
I'm committing as of the 1st of January to one calendar year of fly gear only, unless I have an obligation in a tournament to either team or sponsor. And the reason for it is because I feel like a fly fishing fraud, right? Because I can catch fish on fly, and I think I'm up to nearly 20 species. But so I can obviously cast my line. But in the nature of the my position in Steve's and my business is that we get engaged, go and do things. Usually Steve is given a quest by a TV show or something like that, and we're off to fish a certain spot for a certain species. And so the gear gets put in my hand. So my issue is that I can go and catch the fish, but I have absolutely no understanding of why the particular gear that I'm using was chosen. Does that make sense? And it's so technical, you know, yourself with fly gear. So many different weight rods and so many different lines that can go on that rod, and then all the different flies that you would choose, et cetera, et cetera. And so for me, I just said, well, the only way that I'm going to change this circumstance is if I'm fishing fly, regardless of what Steve's fishing. So the challenge of my fly gear gap year is that no matter where we're sent and what we're fishing for, I've got to find a way to make it work on fly. So it's going to be good, because all the TV shows, all the magazine articles, everything that we're doing it for, Steve can fish whatever he likes, and you know I'm competitive. So I've got to go fly, take him on with fly.
And the acronym's a beauty. It's a floggy. Fly gear gap year. A floggy.
Yeah. And so I have, you said, you raised a beautiful analogy of it. It's kind of like getting off the wagon or on the wagon or something along those lines.
We know that when he's catching stuff on a soft vibe or a little plastic or a vertical jig or something, and you've got the fly line, maybe a sinker or an intermediate, and you're not doing as well, that temptation, like the poor old alcoholic reaching for the bottle of scotch to reach for the spinning tackle will be just excruciating for you.
It will be. That's exactly right. And so that analogy works really well for me, because I've started my page, my Fly Gear Gap here, and the call is out for support. And someone said, oh, my God, it's going to be like Alcoholics Anonymous. We've got to stop you. And I said, exactly. You guys are my buddies. My fly.
Well,
you
know, let's start by putting down some ground rules that we can make up. And I love fly fishing. Mainly in freshwater. I must say, I don't do much saltwater, but tangling with the odd salmon is just the best thing you'll ever do. I'd say one fish on fly is worth 10 on the other tackle. So let's start with that ground rule. So if you could only need to catch one to be up to Steve's 10,
is that
fair enough?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I agree with you 100%. But yes, I am going to need everyone's support in sticking with it, because my promise for the entertainment value to everyone who's following me is that I will vlog my hissy fits. I will blog the things that I learn, and I'm going to be interviewing lots of people. You are on my list for everyone to listen to when I'm doing the research as to how to get it. And I have had the wonderful Matt Trippett throw an additional gauntlet down. When he heard about this, he said, Joe, this is the last time I'm going to ask you. I want you to come and get your fly instructor's certificate with me. I'm going in October for my master's. So there's the gauntlet. So hopefully by the middle of the year, the hissy fits will have diminished. The support from all the people will have kept me on track, and by October I'll be able to pass my fly instructor's certificate. How will that be?
I'm 100% behind you. I'll be your sponsor if you need help. Give us a ring, you know, if you need counselling at any time when you're thinking of going back to the evil side. And look, it's fantastic. And speaking of your casting guru throwing the gauntlet down, just make sure to wear that gauntlet, because when you start catching those giant trevally on fly, you'll get terrible line burn if you don't. let me tell you. Look, we've also got Peter Morse as a regular. Morsey will be there for you. Josh Hutchins will be there for you. All of those people, Greg French, Rob Sloan, Phil Weigel, all of those regulars on The Big Fish who wave the long wand, they'll all be there in your corner. So don't worry, you've got tons of support, Joe.
Yep. Oh, well, I'm counting on it, because you've hit the nail on the head. The reason I'm doing this is because it is just too easy to put the fly rod down and pick up that conventional tackle, and you don't learn anything doing that. So I hope everyone gets on board, gets behind me, gives me a social media pat on the back and says, there, when I'm having my hissies, and gets me to the point where that gauntlet is being pumped in the air with gusto.
Mind you, Morsi, who's listening to this up at Kinchant, sitting on the bank of the lake in the pouring rain, waiting for it, Monsoon Morse, they call him, he'd be listening to you now. He was on earlier in the program saying, well, what's different about that? So, yeah, he's going to fish for his fly, that's all he does. Anyway, yeah. Tight lines, Joe. I think it's a terrific idea. Good luck with the floggy, and thanks for telling us about your great adventures on the Coburg Peninsula. Tight lines.
Tight lines to you all too. Thanks for listening.
Or should I say, from January, tight loops.
True.
Thanks, Joe.
See you later.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.